Our first panel is going to be introduced by Richard Hodes, who is the director of the National Institute on Aging and was probably one of the people, he didn't know it at the time, but helped me get started in research early in my career through some NIA funding for issues related to comparative effectiveness, actually. Richard has been long involved in taking steps to not only improve the basic science around understanding the illnesses and health of older Americans and their well-being in the community, but also practical steps to identify and support effective interventions and their use. So he's been a long-time leader in issues related to comparative effectiveness and particularly issues related to priority populations, including older Americans and people with multiple chronic conditions and people of lower socioeconomic status and racial and ethnic minorities. Richard, we're very pleased to have you today to introduce our first panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. As Mark noted, NIA had the privilege of supporting his career and career development until he exhausted, I think, all possible support mechanisms and decided he had to move along, much to the benefit of the nation and the world. And I thank Mark for his opening remarks and for the introduction to this panel. The panel members who come up to join me, Garth Graham was not able to join us, so Jamila Rashid.
Jamila Rashid is going to be here shortly.
Okay. Lisa Iazzoni? And you, why don't you come up?
Yeah. And Lisa is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and at the Mongan Institute for Health Policy at Massachusetts General Hospital.
And Nancy Roizen, who from Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital. And Mark's request was that we introduce briefly the topics and expand upon them some. As noted, these topics were discussed by the group in some teleconferencing and are reflected in revisions in the draft, which you have. So I think there's a need to simply summarize them briefly and elaborate a bit, and then we'll give an opportunity to the rest of the panel members to elaborate as well, providing most of the opportunity and time, therefore, for discussion. So the first and basic recommendation, developing common definitions of priority populations, is, of course, critical. If we're going to address these populations, we need to define them. Now, in some cases, this seems rather self-evident. The definitions of certain racial ethnic populations, those are defined by age, are rather self-evident. But in other cases, we'll see they are not quite so clear. So the spectrum of disabilities and their definitions, and the cases of chronic diseases and co- or multimorbidities are going to be particular challenges in identifying populations. They need to be identified so that we can evaluate their current status, the existence of disparities, and then target CER towards them. The second bullet recommendation, setting research priorities as related to mission and of agencies and departments, is clearly important. And again, I'll just elaborate a bit. In some cases, the setting of priorities that are targeted at these priority populations will involve, in large part, inclusion to a degree that has not occurred before. That is, there may be common interventions, common studies, common analyses that need to include populations which are more or less applicable to priority populations, but where the status and representation of those populations has been less complete in the past and the challenge is to be inclusive. There'll be other cases where, because of known or emerging information about disparities among these priority populations, we'll be talking about targeting specific studies and potentially specific initiatives. So these are two different areas, but both fall under the important categories of accounting for the populations who, as Mark pointed out, can profit and will profit most by the successful application of CER. Then, in addressing the needs of priority populations, it's important to note that the application of research is going to be directed at both patient and population level decisions. This is, I think, to the gratification of all of us, a part of the definitions that have prevailed at the level of federal Enterprise and CR, including under ARRA. That is, it is broad. It's not simply one drug versus another or one device versus another, but it applies to means of analyzing and delivering health care at the population level, at a societal level. So this is, for many research enterprises, a continuation of the theme that we've already seen, but it will have to continue to include both optimizing of care of the individual and ways in which to deliver the sum or integral of those individual decisions across populations. Of interest, the notion of value of information analysis, and this is a clear one of importance, but also very challenging. So some of the metrics that have been applied in the past have been around concepts termed such things as burden of illness. So they have related to the importance of intervention as it addresses the problem at hand. This relates to the frequency of the problem, how many people and individuals are affected by the severity of the condition as it affects quality of life, as well as financial burden. But importantly, in addition to defining the public health needs and priorities, an important parameter as well is that of scientific opportunity. We deal with all the time. So there will be cases in which there will be needs of high priority, but where scientific opportunities are more elusive or less immediate. And it needs to be emphasized, this is not an excuse or rationale for not addressing those problems, but it points to the need for relating CR to basic and translational research. So in those areas where the opportunities are still more distant for applying CR, this reflects a need to continue efforts at more basic and translational work and to make sure those are tied to CER. They will not all fall under the definition of CER, but CER will be based upon an intensity of basic research as well. gap filling, an important concept. We need to understand those areas which are priorities and of the priorities which are already being addressed and which are not. And I think the recent exercise we had over the past year, stimulated by ARRA, provides some excellent examples of the importance and the challenges and shortcomings of our ability to do this most rationally. So if one finds the IOM report, which did an outstanding job in remarkably short time putting together a list of 100 priorities, they were forced, because of the timing, to do this without the luxury of an opportunity to do a careful portfolio analysis. And in fact, if they had tried to do the portfolio analysis, speaking for NIH, despite our best and ongoing efforts, it would indeed have been quite difficult to be at a high level of confidence of certain of exactly what is happening. So to be illustrative, of the 100 conditions that were, or 100 topics that were judged to be of the highest priority by IOM, when the National Institutes of Health went through and reviewed its current portfolio before the CER initiative, there were 88 of those 100 which are already being addressed to greater or lesser degrees. The approach which we took, I think, is an example of what can occur in response to omnibus or blanket broad solicitations for CER applications under ARRA. We were able to address not only some of the 88 which are already actively supported by additions, and when then a few months ago we assessed to see what gaps remained, we found that over the 25, that is the top quartile of the IOM 100, there were three areas of research which were not being addressed, and so we were able to issue now a targeted funding opportunity, had outstanding responses by investigators in those fields, and are now in the process of reviewing those. So we have to be committed to a better understanding of just what research is ongoing and monitoring that in real time. And as we succeed in some areas, continue there, but also make sure that efforts are directed to those initiatives where we are falling behind in terms of success and moving forward. So gap filling is going to be important, but it's have to be done in the context of improved informatics and analysis of where we're making best efforts. So, Mark, I hope within time constraints, I thought we'd stop there and move along to give then each of the other members of the panel an opportunity to comment briefly and introduce themselves. Jamila, welcome.
Jamila, thank you for being here. Jamila, for those of you who don't know her, is the Associate Director of the Office of Minority Health at HHS, where she oversees research programs. And because of a conflict with Garth Graham, she graciously agreed to be here on short notice. We really appreciate your joining us. I'd like to start down at the end of the table and just go across the table to follow on Richard's excellent summary of the recommendations. And I'll start with Lisa for her views.
Okay. I have a brief about people with disabilities. There's about 54 million Americans currently living with disabilities in the United States. That's about 20% of the population. I just want to make the point that disability rates are much higher in some of the vulnerable populations that we're talking about here today. Obviously, the elderly, but also racial and ethnic minorities typically have higher rates of disability, especially African Americans and Native Americans have very high rates of disability. Now, when I use the words 54 million, that's a lot of people. It's obvious that disability is an incredibly diverse concept. It ranges all the way from children with developmental disabilities to elderly people with Alzheimer's disease to people in middle age with spinal cord injury. In terms of thinking about comparative effectiveness research, the phrase people with disabilities really is not an actionable phrase. It really needs to be honed and focused on for us to be able to begin to, in a meaningful way, identify where the gaps are for comparative effectiveness research. Now, another problem for doing research on people with disabilities is that information about disability is typically unavailable in the traditional data sources where people go to look for it for comparative effectiveness research. It may be kind of shocking to hear this, but even medical records may not very extensively document disabilities such as hearing loss, vision loss, if it's not actively being treated by the clinician. The National Center for Health Services Health Statistics surveys do collect pretty good information about disability, but the traditional discharge abstracts, the claims that are analyzed by so many investigators to look at service use do not have any information on disability in them. People with disabilities can require healthcare interventions on three levels, which require comparative effectiveness research. The first is routine health services that everybody needs, such as screening and preventive services and care for episodic illnesses. The second is care for their underlying disabling condition, such as arthritis, which is the leading cause of disability among adults in the United States. The third is care for comorbid conditions that occur. For example, people with disabilities can also get breast cancer and colon cancer. Comparative effectiveness research studies for the first and third types of interventions have been conducted, you know, studies for breast cancer, studies for routine immunizations. But typically, people with disabilities are explicitly excluded from the clinical trials that are used to create the scientific evidence base. Therefore, the research evidence may not, in fact, apply to certain people with disabilities. It's important to note that some disabilities affect people fairly little in terms of their anatomic or physiologic functioning. For example, if somebody is born blind or born deaf, they may not react any differently to breast cancer treatments than other people. But for somebody who had poliomyelitis as a young person, they may, in fact, respond very differently to breast cancer treatments. And so for certain subsets of populations with disabilities, it's important to do specific analyses on them. Finally, it's important to know, and I'm going to be a little bit political here, that it is important to do studies on interventions that our healthcare system currently may not pay for. Because, in fact, those may be the exact kind of interventions that are going to be most likely to improve the quality of life of people with disabilities. For example, the medical necessity provisions of Medicare and many private health insurers refuse payment for services that are viewed as convenience items or that are not actively improving or restoring function. We don't have much comparative research, effectiveness research on physical or occupational therapy that is meant for just simply maintaining function or preventing its physical declines. Wheelchair technologies with capabilities that are deemed not medically necessary need to have further research on them because, in fact, wheelchair technologies like that can significantly improve the quality of life for people with severe mobility problems. Finally, home modifications could improve the ability of people with disabilities to live independently in their communities and to participate independently in their daily lives. But home modifications also are not often paid for and may not be under the kind of purview of comparative effectiveness research because of that. And so I see that's my comments are about done, but that's where my focus is this morning on disability.
Lisa, thank you very much for your comments, and now I'd like to turn to Nancy Roizen. press the button there.
8-1. The return on investing in the families and the education of young, disadvantaged children is 8-1. That is the conclusion of the University of Chicago Nobel Prize-winning economist, Dr. James Heckman. In studies investing in the families and the education of young, disadvantaged children, the return on the investment of $8 was $8 for every $1 of investment. This is in his article in the 2009 Economics and Human Biology. Probably not very many of us read that. And in the 2006 Science. But maybe you read the January 2006 article in the Wall Street Journal by Dr. Heckman entitled Catch 'em Young. He wrote, there are many reasons why investing in disadvantaged young children has a high economic return. Early interventions for disadvantaged children promote schooling, raise the quality of the workforce, enhance the productivity of schools, reduce crime, teenage pregnancy, and welfare dependency. They raise earnings and promote social attachments. Or, as he goes on to demonstrate, the benefit-cost ratio is 8-1. So why are only 20 of the IOM's selected research priorities for CER related to pediatrics, with maybe 25 more related to adults and children? But how many will actually go to children? Maybe it's already been done. No. Pediatric effectiveness research, even research in choosing the best intervention for children identified with a hearing loss at birth, hasn't had much funding, which actually happens to be topic number one on our list. Actually, this is a perfect topic. Thanks to the 1998 work of Christy Yoshinama Aitano, we know that if we intervene with amplification in education by 6 months of age, we take advantage of the sensitive period of brain development, and these children will have language in the typical range instead of half their age. But we do not know what is the best intervention for each child, so I would give a big vote for number one. Maybe children are not a priority group or a big enough group. Hardly. 24% of Americans are children. 43% of children represent racial and ethnic minorities where there are huge, shocking disparities in health and health care of children as described in the Pediatrics article in March 2010. With higher mortality from drowning, leukemia, congenital heart disease, and if you have Down syndrome, you die 25 years earlier than if you're a minority than if you're white. And 17% of children have a disability. They also have chronic diseases, so they represent four of the priority groups. So will children, where you get your biggest bang for your buck, get their due? Were they well represented on the 23-member IOM committee? I don't think so. Only one of the 17 physician members on the committee was a pediatrician. Thus, the message that I mean to relay to you is one, studies lumping adults and children cannot concentrate on the period 0 to 2 years of age when the brain depends on early experiences to develop incredibly important sensory and language pathways or synapses that we then spend the rest of our life pruning away. Or the 0 to 5 period when Dr. Heckman has told us that the returns are great. This class, children, need to be considered separately so we can get the data, like what Lisa has said, that can make these disadvantaged kids taxpayers. Two, there currently exists very limited clinical effectiveness research in children, but we should fix this problem and not perpetuate it. We need to fund clinical effectiveness research, and the best and the brightest will come and do the work. And the topics on clinical interventions, like topic number 10, which starts in the prenatal period, have the enormous potential to benefit society. And three, If we start by making children, who are 24% of the population, a truly top priority and give them a disproportionate share, one, we can capture the minority priority group, as 43% of children are minorities. Two, we can capture the disability group, as 17% of children have a disability. And three, we can change their trajectory so that as adults, they can live better health, have better health and education, have better occupational outcomes, and make our society more globally competitive with the Heckman 8-to-1 return on investment, and help these kids be taxpayers.
Thank you very much, Nancy. Clearly, you both know a lot about the issue and feel very passionately about it. And I'd like to turn to our next panelist, who also has a long-time commitment to leadership on issues related to comparative effectiveness for vulnerable populations, and that's Jamila Rashid. And again, appreciate your stepping in on short notice, Jamila.
Good morning. Good morning. Yes, very short notice as of yesterday evening. So please bear with me if I ramble a bit. But I want to just say that you're going to hear a common theme here across the three of my two previous speakers and myself, and there is a link as well between racial and ethnic disparities and disabilities, as well as with children. So I just want to highlight a few things. One, I think it's not a mystery to most of you, if not all of you, that the racial and ethnic minority population is growing steadily, and by 2050, it could likely be as high as 50%. And that sends a message to all of us that as we develop these initiatives and programs, that we have to more and more take into consideration the special needs of these populations so that we can better assure that what we're doing will have a greater impact, because it impacts on the lives of all of us. I think it's no mystery to many that racial and ethnic minorities are not only impacted by the fact that they are minority groups, but they also are impacted by many social determinants of health, many things that keep them from having the same equity in health that other populations have: poverty, low education, poor housing, environmental constraints, neighborhoods that are not adequately, do not have the adequate infrastructure to meet their health needs, and so on. And these factors play a role in how and whether CER will actually work in these populations, and we have to take that into consideration. In the Office of Minority Health, we are working on CER, and we have looked at the IOM recommendations, and we've identified those that we feel that we can use to make a difference in the lives and health of the populations that we serve. However, there are others that as we begin to work on this, we're going to have to go back and try and see how do we address some of the other concerns and needs. One of the issues that was raised earlier about persons with disabilities is also for racial and ethnic minorities, and that is their lack of adequate inclusion in clinical trials and in research studies. And this was pointed out by the National Medical Association in one of the first, I believe, the first listening session that the council held, and that cannot go unnoticed or lost in the work that we do. Another point that I want to make is that the need to make sure that we engage the populations because of their special needs, and they differ. American Indian are different from Hispanic Latino and different from African American. So what might be needed in that population could be different or slightly different from what is needed for African Americans. So within the Office of Minority Health, we're using a full-scale engagement approach to how we do CER. We're also using a professional development approach where you take experts, those who are experts in CER, and involve them with established academic researchers and community researchers to work together in a collaborative way, as opposed to having someone do something to these populations. We want the populations to be a part of that, and we think that research that should and could possibly be part of CER research, actually studying how best to get communities and get populations to receive, accept, and use CER rather than just disseminate it and put it out there, but make it usable. Another key point, and I don't know if I'm running out of time or not, I can see far without my glasses, but I can't see far with them.
You're
so,
okay.
Is that we want to make sure that, as I said, that we provide education. When we start our activities, we will spend time doing training, doing education, helping communities to understand. Is that for me? Helping communities to understand what is CER and how will it help them. And then we want them to help us figure out what is the best way to get that information to you? What are the reading levels that you need that information at? How can we use social networking to help you get that information? I think this in itself is a body of research that we could better understand. What do we know about how often when people receive materials in the mail or on the internet, it actually impacts on whether they go to the doctor and it results in an acceptance and a change in their behavior around CER-related activities. You're looking at me now, so I think that's my clue, right?
It's okay. If you have anything else important to say, Jamila, please go ahead. I certainly don't want to make you nervous up here with all the beeps and the looks.
I'll just wrap up by saying that we know that there are certain health conditions. There are leading causes of health. We're putting our focus on those within the Office of Minority Health, and we hope that we will be able to show that by engaging the populations that we want to accept CER in what we do, that in itself will be research that could be used to inform CER going forward.
Jamila, thank you very much, and again, thanks for getting through the beeps and things to be able to participate here this morning. I'd like to start off the discussion with a couple of follow-up questions on all of your comments and on fleshing out these draft recommendations, and I'd like to start with just the definitions here. The first recommendation in this set focuses on a common definition of priority populations and the implementation of that definition. You heard from Carolyn that there are some efforts underway now to actually collect data as part of research studies on race, ethnicity, other important characteristics relating to identifying priority populations reliably. But there are a couple of challenges here. One is that if you look across the different efforts to promote more effective development of evidence for these populations, there are some differences. Maybe some would argue they're not huge differences in what the definitions are. So the economic stimulus legislation, the recent healthcare reform legislation, the IOM and OMB have had somewhat different definitions of vulnerable populations. And I'd like to start by asking if, first, any of you all have any comments about whether these issues are settled enough and for practical purposes, at least, we can move forward clearly on conducting further studies in a way that will be comparable and that rests on some common foundation of definitions, or is there more work to do there? And then second, any promising next steps for actually making sure that these populations can be reliably identified and data on them can be collected in practice, since that seems like a kind of prerequisite for being able to learn something about the effects of the treatments. Any thoughts? Want to start, Lisa?
Yeah, sure. It's a huge issue for people with disabilities. First of all, disability is not a static concept. You know, people's functional status can change over time. You know, gender usually doesn't change. And, you know, people's self-identified race and ethnicity can change in how people identify it. You know, the Census Bureau showed that when they looked at different ways of collecting information on race and ethnicity over time. But I think one of the issues for disability is that the typical ways of kind of making data into bits, the International Classification of Diseases, 9-3 Vision Clinical Modification, ICD-9-CM, which is the classic scheme for classifying diagnoses, just simply does not apply to disability. And the World Health Organization, which is the Uber organization that oversees ICD, has a functional status classification system. It's called the International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health. But for some reason, the United States just has not picked up on it. And there certainly are problems with it. I can't say that it's a perfect classification scheme. But although ICD-9-CM codes appear in every discharge abstract, in every claim that's submitted by providers for reimbursement, there are no ICF codes, no functional status codes. You also have the issue that some people may not want to self-identify their disabilities because they may be afraid of discrimination. They may be afraid of revealing things that they don't want other people to know about them. Or, in fact, they may not view themselves as having a disability, even though they may have a condition such as deafness that, you know, may be viewed as a cultural, linguistic condition rather than a disability, whereas the rest of the world might. And so I think for disability, maybe we should just say people with disabilities and leave it undefined so it's included as a category. But for operationalizing it and then moving on to make actual decisions about what exact type of research needs to be done, we need to think both about collecting information and being more specific about the conditions that are included.
When I think about how are we going to define things, I have a couple of comments. One comment is it wasn't clear to me where poverty fit in this equation. It seems like it should be in the equation someplace. Secondly, in relation to disabilities, I agree with everything that Lisa has said. I think you have to break things down into specific disabilities, and you have to look at what you're doing specifically about high-impact, low-frequency disabilities such as deafness and high-frequency, we'll call it low-impact, disabilities such as ADHD, and you need to, you know, think, and you really need to break them down. I think in relation to children that the issues are very different when you're a teenager, and the issue is what we're trying to look at is suicide or depression, or when you're 0 to 3 and where you, as I have already pointed out, have the opportunity to get much more of an impact for your input, but that there are different ages. And I think the IOM list does identify different ages, and it's important in children.
Yes. In terms of definition, we could look at groups of categories, you know, they're, you know, by race and ethnicity, by age, gender, geography. There are many different categories that could put someone in a priority grouping for CER, and that would be one way of doing it. Another thought that comes to mind for me is looking at criteria such as need and opportunity. What is the need? Is there a need there for CER to improve health and health care for a particular group of people, and what are those needs that exist? And we may, you know, want to look at that. And then is there an opportunity to intervene, an opportunity to identify strategies and ways of disseminating CER and those sorts of criteria that could also come into play. But I do think there is some value in it, not necessarily having it drive decisions, but at least it should be examined and explored and taken into consideration.
I think consistent with what everyone has said, there's certainly importance to identifying the characteristics of individuals who we currently are assigning to priority populations, but I think even more important than identifying those populations with rubrics or titles or labels now and using those to define research of the future is the establishment of a database, an evidence base, that will allow what is likely to be a discovery of relevant priority populations, subpopulations as we evolve. I think the real challenge, Mark, is in a database, be it in healthcare in general or in research, to identify a common database that will allow assortment and assignment to groups and populations as research dictates and as needs dictate.
And do you see a mechanism for doing that now that the comparative effectiveness research is really starting to take off and there is so much attention to getting the infrastructure right?
Well, some CER is going to be carried out in randomized clinical trials where there's a great deal of flexibility in identifying what the minimum data set will be. But a large component, as you alluded to, is going to be, and as Carolyn mentioned as well, is going to occur in observational studies, which are going to take huge advantage of health IT and healthcare reform. So I think as part of those, and those large rubrics is really the place where we need to try to exert influence in establishing a common clinical database that will be accessible for this kind of research. In addition to identifying populations where it's clear there are special needs, we're going to uncover undoubtedly in research cases in which variables of age or disability or race or ethnicity were not suspected to have any relevance, and they will, and we're going to have to redefine groups there. But if I could just identify one example that occurred over the past few years, there was a study carried out supported at NIH to look at confounder effectiveness for interventions to prevent diabetes in those who are at high risk for diabetes. High risk based on clinical diagnosis, short, though, of chemical definition of diabetes. The groups were assigned into three treatments. One was placebo. The other was an oral hypoglycemic, a drug. And the third was a behavioral intervention. At the time the study was put together, there was a suggestion that because individuals at older age groups were likely to have more comorbidities, might be harder to recruit, that there wouldn't be any effort to oversample. In fact, there might be restricted to younger adults without concomitant diseases. And that's when there was some advantage to NIH and its heterogeneity. So the Aging Institute, in collaboration with NIDDK, worked to help assure there was recruitment over a wider age range, including older adults. And the results were not anticipated by any of us. So in young adults, oral hypoglycemics and the behavioral intervention, which was exercise and diet, were equally effective in reducing by approximately half the risk of diabetes. This is one of those trials that was stopped early, not because of adverse effects, but because it was deemed to be so positive that it was unethical to continue people in the placebo group. In contrast, in the age group 65 and older, the drug, the oral hypoglycemic, which was effective in young adults, had absolutely no effect. And in even more impressive, unfortunately, positive contrast, the behavioral intervention was more effective in older adults than anywhere else, producing a 71% reduction in this group, which by age was at highest risk for diabetes. I don't think that anyone predicted the result or could have, but it's a point to emphasize what we've heard from all the panelists, the need for being able to identify groups. With age, it's relatively easy. With other groups, it's going to be more difficult. And then inclusion. If we don't include individuals in these various heterogeneous groups, we'll never determine whether one or another intervention is better for a particular group or subgroup. The extreme of this, Francis Collins would quickly add, is personalized medicine. When we take full cognizance of the importance of subgroups, we'll be careful not to regard them as homogeneous within a group and eventually be able to look at individualization within these priority populations.
Thanks, Richard. One more question, then I want all of you to be ready with your questions and comments for coming to you next. This panel has been focusing on priority setting for priority populations, and In the comments that you all have already made in the report, there are a number of ideas for ways to approach the priority setting process that assures that the most important opportunities are directed. That said, I wanted to push you all a little bit further on ways in which the priority setting process could be improved, and what some of those priorities might be. So as the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute gets up and running, any one particular piece of advice you'd want to give them about priority setting based on the experiences we've had so far? So, for example, Jamila talked about the possibility of having a more community-based process for defining priorities, with the hope that that would not only make the priorities more relevant to the populations that we're focusing on here, but also help with communication and acceptance. And that's something that that ARC is starting to do now. And another issue in the IOM process, there was some discussion about just what was the scope of health care-related comparative effectiveness research. Was it about traditional medical interventions, or should it include, as Nancy rightly emphasized, should it include the fact that many of the interventions that make the biggest difference for especially younger children are not what you might think of as traditional health care, or at least not simple traditional health care? So a quick idea from each of you on making sure that the priority setting process going forward reflects the kinds of goals that this panel has stated.
I'm hoping you'll ask me last, Mark, because it's just so hard around disability because the population is so diverse. And Nancy made the compelling case about children who are born deaf to intervene before 6 months of life. I mean, how could you argue with that not being a priority and trying to have a priority about how to make that happen? But then at the other end, I also made the point that we need to emphasize research that might go beyond the boundaries of traditional healthcare to look at ways to improve quality of life for people with disabilities, looking at, for example, smart homes and technologies that allow people to live more independently in their homes. And so it's just, again, very, very hard for me with a brief of people with disabilities to be able to get too specific because the population is just so diverse, and I'm sorry to wimp out on you that way.
I think that, I mean, even though, as you clearly have heard, I argue very strongly for children to be a top priority, if not a disproportionate priority, I also argue for balance. I think there needs to be, everybody needs a chance. And I, you know, my sort of vision of how you set your priorities is that you have, you know, the high impact, and you have low impact, and you have high frequency, and you have low frequency, and you have safety on, then you turn it the other way, and you have safety, and you have possible benefit. I mean, what possible benefit are we expecting or hoping for? And that we look at it in a multidimensional way, and that people have to, when they're, you know, everything doesn't apply to every situation, but that when people are looking at priorities and applying for these grants, that they have to at least address these different aspects, these different dimensions, and it should be sort of multidimensional.
In terms of scope, it sounds like pretty broad, as long as there's a significant, I mean, you're really focusing on the impact on health.
I think quality of life too. I mean, wouldn't
right.
you?
Yeah. Right. Quality of life and participation. That was
right,
the word that
exactly.
you have used.
Yeah.
You know, do you have a job? Are you participating in your community? I mean, we have to do better in being competitive as a nation.
And things like early education interventions clearly falling within the scope.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, the opportunities are just the earlier opportunities, your cost, the data is so, the amount of money that you have to put in for later opportunities is a lot more for an effect than earlier opportunities. If you get it right, I mean, you might not.
I worked in the National Immunization Program for about 5 years at CDC, before doing some other things there. And we had some terms we used a lot, one being low-hanging fruit and trying to focus on pockets of need. And I think we have some low-hanging fruit within the list of CER priorities, IOM priorities, and then there's some that, of course, may not even be on the list. And so I think there is some value in looking at what are some of those interventions and less important ones on the list that should maybe be brought up to the top, because there are opportunities for us to maybe show whether they're effective or not effective. A lot of resources, for example, by some states and agencies are being used on community health workers, on patient navigators, and those sorts of things. And so those are some areas that perhaps we should look at those types of interventions and see whether we should put some time and energy into really, or raise them up, to really tell once and for all, is there value in those, or are there only value in them for certain types of populations? That would be really valuable to this whole country to know that with these types of groups, yes, community health workers are very important and very effective. But with these others, use something else. Then we can better tailor the use of our resources if we understand that. So too often we kind of put that on the back burner because it's not sexy or whatever. It's not as science-based. But it may be some real value in understanding once and for all what can we get from that, if anything, and who should that be used with?
Well, I think we've heard excellent comments, and I don't want to take any time needlessly repeating them. Would just note that another challenge we're going to have is to do a better job of being aware in real time of what research is ongoing. Duplication in some areas can be useful, but I think there are a number of areas where research has been quite inefficient because of absence of realization of what is ongoing, what is being funded. This talking about low-hanging fruit, this is an easy thing we ought to do. We ought to make sure there's a centralized awareness and database of ongoing research studies. And would just know we've had a fair bit of experience past years in trying to use priority setting. Can't argue with the fact that public health needs and scientific opportunity are the two basic contributors. But in terms of public health needs, we're going to undoubtedly be facing some difficult decisions which involve rather subjective evaluations. And whether it was QALYs or other measures which have been discussed over the years, there have been controversial assumptions that have weighed, for example, the relative value of life and quality of life and years of life at different stages in life. I think we would all like to avoid competition over which age, which condition is somehow more of higher value than another. But these are going to be unavoidable challenges that we face.
Yeah. Good. Well, excellent comments. Let me ask you all to add to this discussion now. If anyone has a question or comment, please raise your hand. Wait for a microphone, which will be coming to you in the back first and up here second. And again, be sure to identify who you are when you ask your question. Thanks.
I'm Mike Millman from the Health Resources and Services Administration, and I just wanted to mention that we were successful in getting some of the Secretary's $400 million, and I wanted to mention three projects that are incredibly relevant to the topic this morning. Two projects, and these are projects that are now solicitations out on the street, soon to close. Two are in the area of pediatrics. One is focusing on pediatric emergency services, and the other is focusing on pediatric office-based practice research systems. And in all of the cases I'm going to mention, the money we got was for infrastructure building, and a big sort of focus of that is going to be how do we use the move into electronic health records and information exchange to be able to use them for comparative effectiveness research. The third project is, I think, could be very unique, and that's we're calling a community health applied research network. And we are going to be funding four research center nodes. These are community health center networks and other community providers that are going to link up with academic affiliates. And one of those is going to be in the area of HIV/AIDS. And so we have the disability here. And the way we argued for this was kind of the Willie Sutton approach. You rob banks because that's where the money is. And we argued you if you want to address underserved vulnerable populations, whether you cut it in terms of economics or racial and ethnic minorities, you go to HRSA programs. And so I think we're in the beginnings of this, of trying to take advantage of some of the infrastructure building we've already started, the movement to electronic health records, and an effort to try to figure out how to do comparative effectiveness research, which I think is the other major issue. It's as we were constantly reminded during the sort of priority setting process, it's not just about doing research or health services research, it's about figuring how to do comparative effectiveness research, which has a lot of some methodological and data issues associated with it.
Thanks for the comment. Any comments? I would definitely appreciate the work on priority setting. We had a couple up here, Jonathan, and one over there, so maybe get the...
Hi, I'm Roberta Carlin from the American Association on Health and Disability, and the presentation was excellent. Thank you. I just have one comment that I think reflects the comments of the presenters about the setting definitions for priority populations. And in the draft document, combining disabilities and multiple chronic conditions, I would recommend that those be separated. They're really very different. And as Lisa said, and was followed by the other speakers, just defining disability for purposes of CER and in research is complicated enough as it is, and then to somehow attempt to integrate chronic health conditions, I think is doing a disservice to both priority population areas. So, thank you.
Comments? Lisa? I know Lisa agrees.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And it does get back to the point that Jamila made, which is that, look, if you take these priority populations together, we're really talking about something approaching a majority of the population. I mean, this is a big part of the overall population, the health opportunities, is where the money is in terms of opportunities to improve health and have an impact. And that really does suggest a higher degree of attention to both the definitions and applying the definitions, collecting the data and research, as Richard said. And I think that's going to be a pretty big challenge given the scope of the work here. You all think we're up for it?
Yes.
We have to be.
All right. I know Jonathan had a comment here.
Thank you. Jonathan here from Resilient Network Systems. First of all, great presentation. I have a question. I've looked at a lot of the plan designs and study designs for comparative effectiveness research, and it seems like the first step is de-identify the data so we can get the rights to use it. And when you do that, you basically lose the ability to correlate that data with other data sets, things like behavioral background, socioeconomic status, disability status, just about all sorts of stuff. And I look at the definition, what are the definition of the priority populations? How would you query the database and sort of filter out the priority populations if you've eliminated any ability to sort of cross-index with other sources? How do you eliminate confounding errors if you can't capture, you have no ability to capture the data from these other sources? And on a related topic, how do you then use this intelligence and make it actionable by linking it into care delivery? I think if you add up all the money spent on comparative effectiveness research, it's got to be a fraction of 1% of overall healthcare delivery. And if you're not able to integrate it back, once you've de-identified the data, you do some analytics, it's basically impossible to reach back out to the caregivers and the patient, add any value, and get sort of a feedback loop. So the question is for Richard and Mark, since Mark knows everything, is there any...
I'm just the moderator.
Is there been any progress in sort of a systematic way for capturing data from diverse sources, sort of not irreversibly de-identifying it, using it, and then linking it back into care delivery environments.
All right, well, as the moderator, before putting the rest of the panel a little bit on the spot about this, just a reminder that, I mean, those are good questions, and we're going to come back to them in our next panel on infrastructure for conducting the research, and then for our third panel on using the evidence that's developed. But these are issues that relate to priority setting, too, and important challenges, and priorities will hopefully find a way to address them. Any comments?
Do you want to defer it?
No.
I have an easy comment. We'll send our folks that are going to do that to the next panel, and they'll deal with it there, because it is a a bit
needs
of a challenge.
Needs to be done, right? Yeah, Lisa.
Yeah, I do have a comment, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to say this crisply, so I apologize, Mark, in advance. I personally believe that the view of the person with a disability about their functional impairment has inherent validity. But a lot of physicians say, oh, no, that person's too subjective. They can't objectively evaluate their disability. And so they insist on having a physician come in and evaluate the functional status of somebody. But in fact, physicians often see patients at their worst. You know, they're sick. They come into the office because they're feeling poorly. They don't see them when they're out in the community, when they're living their daily life. And so they really do not have a good perception of exactly what the functional status of that person is. And so I think whatever data systems are created need to be able to include the perspectives of the person with disability about their own functioning. And in fact, the small research body of research that has looked at this has showed a lot of discordance between physicians and patients in terms of self-rating the patients of their disability and the physician's ratings. And again, as I said, I think patients have an inherent validity there. And so whatever data systems are designed need to maybe include both perspectives, but I think scientists need to increasingly respect that the view of the person with a disability needs to be, at the end of the day, the view that dominates.
Indeed, with this greater emphasis on personalization, as Richard was saying, and more reliance on individuals for providing the data seems like something that could be reflected in the
priority. Yeah, but it's going to require a mindset among our profession change. Yeah.
Richard?
All good comments. In terms of subject reports, you know, I think there is some progress being made defining the right query instruments that are,
yes,
amenable to databasing is important, mm-hmm, and there is some progress. But the basic challenge, I think, is always going to be there, trying to protect the rights to privacy with the value of having extensive information that is ultimately potentially identifiable as a fodder for research. And there have been certainly, Mark probably does know better than anybody else from experience here, but there have been a number of approaches taken that will continue to be needed. There's the use of enclaves and confidentiality agreement that, under highly regulated circumstances, allow limited access to data which is potentially identifiable, but with very stringent restriction to access to those data. There is the format of informed consent, so that I think, you know, Joel will be talking about VA. There are opportunities there for large populations who may choose to participate with rather global consent. They have to, now informed consent is a challenge here, but individuals who are willing to ease, if you will, constraints on personal identifiers for in the interest of research. But there's never going to be a way, I think, to avoid the importance of respecting confidentiality in individuals and having the very most informed consent when that is being compromised in any way.
And we are going to come back to these important methodologic issues in the later panels and the further work on this effort. We're just about out of time. I know there's some more questions, and there's one here. We'll see if we can get through that. May not get to all of them here, but we will be coming. We'll have more time for discussion in the later panel.
If I'm talking, yes, thank you. I'm Peggy Turk from SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse. And I'd like to thank the panel for the presentation and starting us off, I think, very nicely. I have a question in regard to that dirty word called cost. And that is that people have talked around it, have mentioned it briefly, and yet I'm very much aware of issues of cost because of my practice. I'm a physician in physical medicine and rehabilitation in pediatrics. And what we see is that cost of care is really one of those limiting factors. And so it seems to me that that might make your list, Nancy, of what is the high and the low impact. And yet I know we don't talk very much about cost. Lisa, I think you also mentioned some cost issues as well. But I wonder if the panel might make some comments, recognizing that, of course, we're looking for effectiveness of interventions, but would cost have any impact as well?
I think cost is an important issue. What do you all think?
In disability, Peggy, I agree, cost is an important issue, but it's also cost beyond the patient. It's cost to the families, to the caregivers, to the community. And so if we're going to go around cost for people with disabilities, that we need to, it's like putting the pebble in the pond, we need to look at the ripple effects.
Once again, I think that it's, as you say, it's the elephant in the room, so to speak. And I think your comment to low-hanging fruit was a comment to cost. Let's get the easy, quick, cheap things done. And I think it has to be in that multidimensional equation. And then we have to consider what is this going to mean for a whole life or a whole society if Susie gets her cochlear implant and she can be sort of mainstreamed forever, is it worth the cost?
It is the elephant in the room, and if it's an elephant in the room, it's better off acknowledging it in the process.
Yeah, I know you're short on time, but I just want to echo Lisa's comments. There are other non-monetary costs that we have to factor in.
Very important. And we all are short on time. I know there's some more questions. We're going to try and hold them for the upcoming discussion. But right now, I'd like to thank our first panel for doing a really good job of getting us started. Thank you.